Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today, we have Dr. Monica Rico with us, who is a professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. She is also affiliated with Lawrence's Environmental Studies program, and her teaching and research explores American cultural, intellectual, and environmental history in the early American period and the 19th century. She has a particular interest in the connections between gender studies and environmental studies, as well as public history and community-based teaching and learning. She is the author of Nature's Nobleman, Transatlantic Masculinities, and the 19th Century American West, and multiple articles and book reviews, including Don't Forget This, Annie Oakley, and The New Girl in Anglo-American Culture in the Popular Frontier, Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Transnational Mass Culture, edited by Frank Christensen. Her research focuses on the connections between visual culture and natural history in the 18th century Atlantic world. Today, we discuss several topics related to history, masculinity, and teaching within academic institutions. We were pleasantly surprised that our conversation discussed the importance of museums. We were not expecting our conversation to go there, but we are both really happy that it did. Lastly, we were having some audio issues at the very beginning of the episode, but I wanted to share with you that Dr. Rico was a professor of mine back in 2006, and despite me not doing particularly well in her course, she was very willing to speak with us on the podcast. We hope you enjoy the episode. Monica, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We're excited to have you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was really a surprise to be asked, a really pleasant surprise. And I've been listening to a lot of your episodes to get ready for this conversation. And I'm really excited to be part of it. I had so many interesting guests on. So
I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about yourself and who you are and maybe share parts of your personal or professional identities that are important for our listeners to know about.
Okay. Professionally, I am professor of history at Lawrence University, which is a small liberal arts college in Appleton, Wisconsin. I teach history and I also teach in the environmental studies program. I primarily teach early American history, women's history, gender history, environmental history, but it's a small department, so I cover like a pretty broad range of topics, but almost most of them are related to early America in one way or another. And I probably should clarify that term early America. It's really the term that it refers to the time period that might be more familiar to some listeners as colonial America. And that's kind of been, it's perceived as a little outdated because it really defines this complicated and diverse history, primarily in terms of its colonial relationship to one European nation, the United Kingdom. And admittedly, the term early America, like early in relation to what, is still colonialist, and it's people have problematized it. Mm-hmm. But to set all of that aside, we're really talking about the 17th and 18th century and a little bit of the 19th. So I'm a teacher. I'm a writer. I've written a book that was about transatlantic masculinity in the 19th century. And I'm currently working on a number of different projects. I'm also pretty active in my community. I've been really involved with some initiatives for downtown, kind of working with the city to think about where the downtown neighborhood of my community is going. I've been on the board of a local museum for many years. Personally, though, you know, it's interesting. Like, one reason why I decided to get involved in the community here in northeastern Wisconsin was that I moved here about 20 years ago after having spent pretty much my whole life in the San Francisco Bay Area, except for a couple of years living in New York City. So I didn't really know what the Upper Midwest was like, and I felt pretty alienated when I got here. The weather, the lack of diversity. My mother's Chinese American, and my father's parents were not born in this country. One of them immigrated to the United States from Spain, and the other one was born in Spain but came here by way of Cuba and Mexico. So yeah, like it took me a while to feel at home in the Upper Midwest. But now, you know, I mean, you live in a place long enough and you make an effort to connect to it and to be part of, you know, there was a period where I sort of would roll my eyes and think like, oh, it's, here are all the things that are wrong with it. And then I realized, well, I could be part of the solution. And so, yeah, I definitely feel more rooted here now. So that's a little bit about my professional and personal identities. I think one other thing is, you know, I was thinking about this as I was listening to some of your other guests, and feminism for me has been so embedded in what I think about and how I work and my politics. And by politics, I mean like a very broad range of practices and thoughts that I almost never really think like, do I define myself as a feminist? Like, do I define myself as an earthling? Like, it's just, you know, but it is like, that's a huge part of my approach to just about everything. And intellectually, I owe a major debt to women's historians and gender historians and the people who really took feminist theory and used it to kind of explode ideas about what history was and what it wasn't.
I was hoping to cover this a little bit later in the podcast, but it might be relevant to talk about now. I'm curious about these lost narratives that you were talking about before we recorded, these lost narratives of women and really kind of the refinding of those narratives. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So for years, you know, for many, many years, and this might still be the history with which a lot of your listeners kind of think about when they think about history. It really centered on military and political history that was dominated by men. And women were perceived as really marginal to history. And then in the 70s, really as an outgrowth of the women's movement, there was an effort to challenge that idea and that definition of history. There's a really, the sort of classic example that gets used in a lot of women's history courses is a article by a historian named Joan Kelly. And the title of the article was, Did Women Have a Renaissance? And in the article, she made the point that whereas we're often, you know, for, and they were, I was taught this in the 80s too, like for a long time, the story was the Renaissance was the time when people became more free. Like, you know, they liberated themselves from these ideas of, you know, backwardness or whatever. And Kelly points, she asked, did women have a renaissance? And what she points out is that the whole concept of the renaissance as being liberating or as like enabling more exchange of thoughts really only applied to men. And that if you really scrutinized what women's lives were like, that they actually had a lot more independence and a lot in the late medieval period than during the Renaissance. And that, in fact, the Renaissance was not at all this like time of expansion and freedom for women. So in my own field of American history, there was an effort to find the stories of women, tell those stories, and to be inventive about what kinds of evidence you could use to uncover that. And sometimes that meant doing things like statistical analyses of birth records that could be found in like church archives, or looking, usually records of marriages would record the age of the woman getting married. And you could look at that, and you could look at the age of her husband and build up a data set and analyze that. So people began looking at visual sources, advertising, using literary sources like novels to just try to really get at what women's experience has been. And kind of, again, sort of mirroring the feminism and the feminist movement in a larger sense, that historical activity also got challenged by women of color who said, you know, if you're going to tell women's history, you have to talk about Black women, you have to talk about Native women, you have to talk about immigration. We can't just tell the story of women if it's like a group of sort of white middle-class Protestant women. And so there was a kind of, it's really intersectional because a lot of the women who are doing the really important work in women's history were also women of color who were doing really important work in Black history or in Asian American history. And eventually, or really, I don't know, in some ways contemporaneously with that, there's been a, you know, also an effort to uncover LGBTQ history. So now when I teach women's history, I try to include a really broad range of stories to really bring students to a new thinking about what history is. So to show them like Harriet Jacobs, for example, who is sexually harassed by her enslaver. She's a Black woman. She's living in slavery in North Carolina in the 1830s. She has a relationship with a man who is not her enslaver. She has two children. Eventually she runs away and hides from her enslaver for 7 years. Before she's able to get to freedom and be reunited with her children. And then she becomes really active in the abolitionist movement. So I wanted students to know about Harriet Jacobs. I wanted them to know about a non-binary person who turns up in a court case in Virginia in the 1600s. And when they ask, when they're asked by the magistrate, are you a man or a woman? They say, I'm both. Sometimes I'm a man, sometimes I'm a woman. And there's this whole fascinating court case where people are like, man, woman. And they're just kind of like, well, you know, here's my life story. You can make of it what I will. And it, you know, talks about how they like go to sea and then they like work as a seamstress. And sometimes I'm dressing like a woman. And so I wanted students to like hear about people like that and to realize that, you know, there's nothing wrong with like the more traditional history. It's good. We do need to know those things. But if that's all we've got, then then we've got a really impoverished view of the past, which means a really impoverished view of ourselves. I want everybody to realize, like, people like them are makers of history. Mm-hmm. You know, whether like women, trans people, blind people, you know, enslaved, migrants, illiterate people, like everyone's important. Everybody's part of the kind of larger story. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to kind of tie it back to the issues of therapy, I think it can be healing for people to have that realization.
Yeah, it brings me to the idea of what we think of as knowledge and what we think of as historical knowledge. I think knowledge itself is really difficult to make sense of. How do you talk about knowledge? But I think from a historical perspective, can you speak to what we think of as historical knowledge? What do we call historical knowledge?
That's such a great question. So people often think, and this is not, it's not surprising that they think this because it's sort of the way we're given to understand what history is, that there's just these like facts, they're out there, and historians sort of go around like they're gathering Easter eggs, and they just like find the facts and pluck them up and then like put them in the basket. And while there are certainly like observable events that turn up in records that can be corroborated in such a like vast array of other records that we can pretty much say affirmatively, like, yes, this happened. A lot of things are much more sort of contingent and nuanced than that. So like that the Holocaust happened, that's a fact. Like that's not, you know, sort of up for like interpretation or debate. However, you know, what are the origins of those events? How did people experience it? What forms of resistance did people assemble? All of that has to be determined from looking at a lot of different kinds of evidence. And the way historians approach that evidence is by reading and thinking a certain mm-hmm. way. There's a cognitive psychologist at Stanford named Sam Weinberg, who's actually done some really interesting studies of how historians think. So he gathered together a bunch of like normal people and a bunch of high school seniors in an AP history class and a bunch of historians and gave them all the same like three sets of things to read, a bunch of documents about the Civil War and about Lincoln specifically. And what he found was that the historians had a particular way of reading these documents. Most people kind of read them for the content, like what is said in this. But the first thing that historians did was try to figure out like who said this. Before they even read the content of the document, they said, who wrote this? Like, was it Lincoln? Was it Stephen Douglas? Was it a newspaper reporter watching an event? So that was the first thing. The second thing is when did it happen? Like, is this something about Lincoln from 1860? Is this something about Lincoln from 1864? That matters. So this is just a very small example of the ways in which historians take what is, you know, after all, like any kind of reading is as a cognitive operation, really, really quite complicated. But what professional historians do is try to read in such a way that knowledge is so that our thinking about the past is more situated contextually. Nothing's just kind of like floating out there in space, disconnected from everything else that's going on around it. Any given piece of evidence has to be understood like against the like overall backdrop. So, you know, there's this sort of joke that historians use anecdotes as data, which I suppose is true. I mean, in the sense, like sometimes you can actually have historical data sets. It is possible, of the kind I was talking about a few minutes ago. But, you know, we're left with what's left to us, right? Like we've got traces. We're like, you know, we've got CSI. We've just got to like come in and like pick the fibers off the carpet. Like we don't really have the luxury of being able to like, you know, gather, like we can't do an experiment on the past in the same way. We can do counterfactuals. You know, we could maybe even run computer models of the past, but we can't set up an experimental situation. And we can't really do, you know, like a statistically valid kind of normed survey of like people's thoughts about their experiences. So historical knowledge is specific and it's particular. And it's contextual, and yet that doesn't mean that everyone's opinion is equally good. I think there's like sometimes the opposite misconception, which is like, well, then it's just a question of everybody's opinion, and I think slavery was good, and you think slavery was bad, and like, oh well, we'll just have to disagree. There are better and worse interpretations, and the better ones are the ones that are more consistent with the evidence.
Mm-hmm. What you were saying just a few minutes ago was really resonating with me, and it made me think of the work that we do as psychologists, specifically people who are more interested in psychoanalysis. And I was thinking about just knowledge and oftentimes how difficult it is to understand a patient without looking maybe not so much at the facts but the latent content of what's being said. So maybe not the words necessarily that are coming out of the mouth of the patient, but really what's underlying that. And it sounds a lot like how historians function as well. I was getting the sense of very much like a psychoanalysis happening within the field of history.
Yeah, you know, it's really, that is fascinating. There was, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, kind of an effort to do psychoanalysis of history. And some of it, like, actually is pretty thoughtful and useful. But what you're saying, I think, is something a lot more sophisticated, which has to do with the ways in which sometimes where there's a joke or a silence, or there are ways in which people sort of talk about things without talking about them, and you can definitely get that out of some historical texts. I think there's also a sense in which, and maybe this is part of the, like, I don't know, I've never been a therapist, so a lot of historians I know are sort of embarrassed to say this because it sounds sort of like, you know, naive. But many of us feel like a kind of responsibility to the people that we write about. I don't know if that's true for people who write about like people who've done really horrible things, but like, I mean, the people in my first book were mostly men. They were very privileged. They were really interested in big game hunting, because one of the things I was interested in was hunting as an activity and what it says about masculinity and nature. So I don't hunt, you know, I'm not this like British guy who wants to go on safari, but I still felt this sense of, There was a kind of empathetic imagination that was required to really put together my history. I had to sort of set aside myself and kind of you know, I felt like, well, all right, apparently I'm telling your story, so I'll try to do it the best that I can. And so even with, like I said, I mean, even with a group of people that, you know, in many ways I actually found really unsympathetic, I still wanted to make sure that I represented their story in a way that felt true to the voices I had heard in their writings. And that's not to say that it would be like, if they could come back and read it, they might, in fact, they probably would, like, not necessarily like agree with it. But in the way I wrote it, in the way I assembled the narrative, I really tried to kind of create like a kind of rhetorical space in which their perspectives could be heard. And I think in some ways, I mean, my experience in therapy has been like, that's a lot of what a good therapist does, is just kind of like create this ground in which like the speaker can kind of hear themselves. A lot of the sort of breakthroughs I've had personally in therapy have happened when somehow like I've just found myself saying things and then I sort of have to stop and go, wait a minute, that's really, what did I just say? That was really interesting. Can we like, did you hear me say that? What was that? And I don't know. I mean, a historian has to be a sympathetic listener, which isn't always to say like a soft listener or a, like a, you know, not naive. I think there has to be kind of like a tough empathy to be a historian. And I think that's probably true for in mental health as well. It's definitely true in education. I think it's really,
yeah.
Like, I think being a teacher requires tremendous compassion and empathy and like heart openness. But you also have to be not tough in the sense of being like a hard ass. I'm not sort of trying to valorize that sort of attitude, but strong-minded enough to kind of insist on the integrity of the educational process. And that can mean like kind of defending that process against any number of different like entities that want to distort that process. But it can also mean, you know, compassionately setting boundaries for students, for example. I mean, Laura, I know you were a teacher, right? So you probably know a little bit of what I'm talking about. And some of those boundaries are even there.
Oh, just, absolutely.
You know, kind of keep your own sanity. But some of them are also...
No, I was thinking about when I was...
Go on.
When I was... training to become a teacher, I was taught to be warm but strict. That was the phrase that they always used, was you have to be warm with your students, but you also have to be strict with them. And so that really brought back those memories when you're just talking now.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot in the context of teaching at a small college. My own educational background was not in the liberal arts setting. I got a liberal arts education. I mean, you know, like my bachelor's degree is in history and political science. And, you know, I took like a broad range of courses, blah, blah, blah. But I went to a community college for 2 years, and then I went to a big state school. And then I stayed at my big state school for graduate school. But my undergrad experience was so different from what my students have today. In many ways, I think, you know, what my students have is a lot better. They have a lot more personal attention. But I think when I first started teaching in the liberal arts environment, I was a little surprised at the kind of degree to which faculty and students were sort of expected to interact. I think there's a lot of value to the community building that happens in that environment. But at the same time, there has to be a certain kind of detachment. It's almost Buddhist, like You have to be deeply compassionate and also really quite detached. Like, you know, you're not me. Like, this isn't about me. This isn't my ego. This isn't about reproducing myself. You know, you get to make your own choices, even if that means the choice to fail. You're on your journey. Maybe you need to fail right now. Maybe you need to, like, leave college right now and come back to it 10 years from now. What do I know? It's your life. You know, so I think, I don't know, we've kind of strayed pretty far away from history here. But as a historian, my historian's life is very much bound up with teaching. It is difficult for me to, like, separate those two things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you also have the, if you want to call it an identity or whatever you want to call it, of being an author too. And I did want to make some space to talk a little bit about your research because it integrates so many fascinating ideas. And I'm curious if you would want to speak a little bit to your research and your book that you published a while. I guess it was published fairly recently now, but
it's been a while. The book came out in 2013, so it's been a while. Hopefully there will be another book not too far from now. One of the things that drew me to history as a discipline was that it was a writerly kind of scholar's activity, that the best history books that I knew were also, like, beautiful pieces of writing. And the history teachers that I really admired were people who took writing seriously, who pushed me to become a better writer, who themselves had written books that I thought were really well written. So, and in some ways, history as a discipline doesn't exist outside of the telling. Like, there's story built into history. There's been a lot of theoretical work kind of expended on this idea. In some ways, like, the presence of narrative itself patterns and shapes the way we think about what's happening in the past. You can even see this, like, when you're reading, like, there'll be, like, these declension narratives, like environmental history often has this. Once things were, like, good and there was no pollution, and then a certain number of people came and they built a factory or whatever, and then, like, everything went downhill. Or, you know, you have, like, the American story. This is a progress story. Progress, like, you know, from like, small origins to greatness or what have you. So I thought a lot about narrative. What I ended up doing was writing a book that was very much about people, which wasn't really, like, au courant. Like, it was, like, I felt a little awkward, you know, I was supposed to write something a little bit more theoretically sophisticated, I guess, or, you know, there wasn't, like, a whole, like, you know, rigorous quantitative analysis or anything. But what you become the person, I don't know how to put this, but you have to learn from your mentors and your influences, but you also have to figure out, like, okay, what kind of practitioner am I meant to be, right? Like, there are a lot of good ways to be a good historian, so what's my way? And it turned out that my way was going to have to be, like, a very person-centered way. Like, I automatically think biographically, I automatically think in terms of life stories. And so I wrote a book that was very much organized around five individuals. Like, each chapter was basically about a different person, four men, one woman, and, like, their deal, what was going on with them. And I didn't really know any other way to do it. For a while, I was sort of worried that it would just kind of be this, like, weird compendium of, like, here are some random people from the past that are interesting. But once I realized that the thing that I could talk about in relation to all of these people were their struggles with gender and the way in which they patterned their struggles with gender onto a particular encounter with the natural world, then it all kind of fell into place. And the projects that I'm working on now, one of them is very, very biographical. The other one, not quite so much, but I'm still very much a person who loves history because I think it's very human. It's one of the humanities. I think it helps us understand what it means to be human. I was just actually reading this quotation today from to prepare my students. There was a historian named Mark Bloch, Bloch, who in the 1920s was kind of foundational to creating a whole new kind of type of historical study, and has become kind of admired among historians for a number of reasons. First of all, like very influential as a historian, but also kind of as an example of like moral rigor when the Germans invaded France. Bloch was in the French army. He managed to escape capture and join the resistance, and then he was captured and executed by the Nazis. And so, you know, like he's our own personal historian, like French resistance hero. But there's this thing he wrote in his book, The Historian's Craft, which is an unfinished manuscript that he left. He was actually literally working on it while he was like in the underground resistance, like just jotting down his thoughts about how to do history, where he says something like, the good historian resembles the ogre of legend, where he smells human blood, that's his prey. And I love it because it's kind of like a slightly creepy thing to say. And there is, you know, I mean, here I am, I'm talking about empathy and so on, but there's also something like a little voyeuristic and a little exploitative about doing history sometimes. Like you are rummaging around in these people's lives, but like it's exciting. That's kind of the adventure of being a historian, is that you get to be really close to these people that often are really just have, you know, these extraordinary lives, and find out what's going on with them. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I keep thinking about how it does. It really does. And I keep thinking about how much our society would benefit from having a more historian mindset, for lack of a better way to put it. But you used this phrase earlier that really stuck out to me. You said empathetic imagination, and that was something you had to tap into when you were writing your book. And I just keep thinking about how life-changing that would be, and how influential that would be for our society and for some of the social issues and social justice movements that we've seen recently. If only we could get people in that kind of mindset where they pay attention to context. And they're taking a more empathetic look at kind of what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's not random or accidental that in the past year, there's been a certain amount of reckoning with history, to reckon with racial injustice everywhere, but we'll use the specific situation of the United States to keep our thinking manageable, to reckon with racial injustice in the United States, you must reckon with the past. That is my contention. I suppose other people would say, no, why rake that up? But I think if white people really want to like sit back and listen to the voices of people of color, and in particular Black people, they need to think about history. I think some of the things that have happened under the Trump administration with the pandemic, with Black Lives Matter have really gone to one of the most enduring and painful conundrums of American life. How is it that a society that is ostensibly founded on freedom is provably, like, you know, palpably, clearly founded on enslavement and dispossession? How is that possible? And the fascinating and tragic thing about it is, like, it's not just mere hypocrisy. It's not just that, oh, these people didn't really believe in freedom. They were just kind of paying lip service to that. There were a lot of profoundly radical aspects of American life. The rejection of the idea that there has to be an established religion for the entire country. The rejection of the idea that there's going to be a hereditary nobility. You know, those were radical contentions for their time. And yet, you know, there were limits. Freedom for some, but not for all. And the case has been made, and this is not original to me, like this has been a case that's been made by other historians. And, you know, if people sort of want to just Google something like history, racial justice, syllabus, like they'll find a bunch of readings. Go to the 1619 Project, you'll find a lot of this. What historians have come to see is that it's not just a mere paradox. It's not a bug. It's a feature that in order to think freedom, there had to be a kind of thinking of unfreedom. In order to think of like a country of where every parenthesis white man could own land and be his own boss and be his own master instead of like a peon or a peasant, there had to be people who would have their land and their lives stripped away from them. And so we have to have a kind of truth and reconciliation process. And we've been called to account for this by many, by Black thinkers, by Asian American thinkers, by like, this is not like a new call. Like W.E.B. Du Bois was talking about this like 100 years ago. But sadly, it's still urgent. You know, this is unfinished work that has to be done. And I think that I'm not really an expert on intergenerational trauma, but I think the ways in which racial dispossession, oppression, injustice manifest themselves in people's like psychic pain, in their abuse and their addictions and their you know, intrafamilial violence, and all of that stuff is, you know, people are walking around with like the wounds of history on them. You can see this in the indigenous communities. So history is, it's critical to I think the process that we need to have if we want to envision like a more compassionate and just society. And certainly, you know, in this country, we're not the only people who are dealing with this. Like there have been similar kinds of processes evolving around justice for Aboriginal people in Australia, or efforts to document people who were prisoners of the Gulag under Stalin. I mean, any generally, like generally, I don't know how to put this, but when people want to talk about justice, they very often end up talking about history. And it's not because they just want to like rake over the past or like cling to it or that they can't move on, right? It's like the same thing with therapy. Until people work through it, it's just going to keep returning on them in some way. Like, there's no way to go around it. You just have to look at it.
Yeah. You bring up such a good point, and I want to make sure to talk about this in the episode. I'm curious if there are any thinkers that have really helped you with this process in yourself, and are there any specific thinkers that you really like to talk about in your classes?
Oh, wow. You know, I would say, first of all, though, a lot of what I feel like I've learned about this, I've learned from talking to friends who are also historians who, you know, really had the love in them to educate me and to suggest, like, read this, or have you thought about this, or you know, maybe we could look at history in this way. So I'm really fortunate to be working in history at a time when there is a lot of like very vibrant scholarship happening. And social media has really amplified some voices. Like, you know, social media's got its downside, sure. But, you know, if anybody's interested in learning more about some of these things, like some of the people to follow would be like Annette Gordon Reed, who's written a lot about Thomas Jefferson, or Kevin Cruz, or I'll give you some like suggestions to put into the show notes.
Sure, yeah.
But in terms of thinkers that have been really, you know, influential for me, you know, it's, I don't know if I could really point to any, like, there are definitely historians whose monographs I admire, but I don't know that I would really have students read that so much. I think what I would say is that there's always been like alternative voices in American history. And they're not as hard to find as they used to be because we do have like the internet. And so people are sometimes amazed to find out like that, you know, in the 1830s, there's a Black woman named Mariah Stewart who's speaking in public about her faith and about being a woman and about being Black and calling for abolitionism. And she's doing all of these things, right? Like in the 1820s. People are sort of amazed to hear about that. People are kind of amazed to see so many kind of examples of people like that in history. And so I don't know if there's any particular like theorist or thinker or book particularly that I want to gesture towards, just more kind of, you know, I would encourage people to just like be curious. I will say, you know, it's not even so much a book, but I love museums. I love them professionally, but I also just like think museums are fun and cool, and I like to go to museums. And I think in some ways, like, even, it's sad because museums are struggling, not least because of the pandemic, but there are so many good museums out there these days. Like, you know, the Museum of Chinese in the Americas in New York City is an amazing place. You know, the National Museum of African American History in Washington is, there are like hundreds of stories in that building. So, you know, it's like it doesn't have to be a book that you read or even a website that you look at. You can just like check out a museum. Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm so glad. I'm also, I love museums as well. And I always forget to talk about museums. I don't know why that is. I really have to think about why I don't talk about museums more, but I'm so glad you brought that in. I don't think about that often.
Well, and there is this sort of intersection between museum and memorialization. For example, if you go to the United States Holocaust Museum, like, yes, it's about history and like they present you with historical information, but it's also very much a memorial. And there's literally like, you know, spaces set aside in the building for people to kind of reflect and process. It can be like a hard place to visit, right? Like it's upsetting. And as a mat, and this is good sort of, these are sort of best practices in museum design. Like they specifically, you know, and they do this at the National African American History Museum too. They'll specifically sometimes like put like a wall or a screen in front of things that like people need to choose for themselves, whether or not that's something they want to see. And they'll sort of give them like a kind of content warning, like this may not be suitable for your children to see, or, you know, you may choose not to see these graphic images. But even if, you know, even if you sort of don't do that, like it's still, you know, intrinsically upsetting. And so there are spaces where people go to reflect, and spaces like this museum were, you know, particularly built as educational or cultural institutions, but also as efforts to, you know, advance that like kind of confrontation with history, mm-hmm. to sort of promote the best museums, promote conversations between the people who go to them. They kind of give visitors a way of triangulating onto topics that are otherwise quite difficult to discuss. Like, you know, you don't necessarily like just hang out with people, you know, and really, so what are your thoughts about the Holocaust? But a good museum like that one will foster reflective conversation about these important and painful issues, and help people understand themselves better, help people ideally, you know, gain empathy, and ideally inspire people to you know, act for justice when the opportunity presents itself. But, you know, these are ongoing histories. These stories aren't really over. So when you leave the museum, what are you taking with you? So some of the things I think I said a few minutes ago about truth and the need for a reckoning and so on, I think some of the places where we come most face to face with that are in these designated kind of memory spaces. Mm-hmm. You know, so even something like the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, which isn't really, you know, indicated as a historical space per se, like not especially informative, will ideally, you know, spur people to learn more. I think especially as, you know, as the generation that personally experienced the Vietnam War passes away, it's really something that, like, it is becoming history, like in the books, nobody remembers it history. Personally. So a memorial like that has a lot of work to do.
I used to live about a block away from where Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. And I did spend quite a bit of time in that museum. And this conversation that we're having is really resonating with me, providing a space to not only reckon within yourself, but also, you know, in terms of the society. And I mean, it truly did change me. And I can certainly see how museums can have enormous impacts on other people. It's not only that you're reading, but you aren't experiencing exactly what other people experience, but you kind of get a sense of it, and there's a space for it. And I'm so glad that we're talking about museums. I didn't even think about bringing this up today in this conversation, but I'm really glad we did.
Well, partly, again, I mean, I'm not myself a museum professional. I don't have a degree in curatorial interpretation, but I do teach a very introductory class in public history, which includes things like oral history in museums and historical preservation and things like that. And there is a whole, I'm not really the person to talk to about this. Like I said, this isn't really like within my particular professional expertise, but there is a lot of really exciting kind of community-based historical work going on to sort of do the process of gathering people's stories and then interpreting them or contextualizing them within that broader framework. And often this happens museologically, but it can also happen, you know, like in an online space, for instance. And there's a place where this kind of thing even sort of blurs into, like, I guess what, for want of a better term, you could call like an artistic installation. So that might mean like a kind of like performance art thing. There was I forget exactly the details of this, but there was a really fascinating thing that happened in Britain to commemorate the World War I, which just, you know, had its like centenary, and they had men who were dressed like soldiers, just kind of like walk around like London silently and like sit on trains and things. And if people like asked them like, you know, what the heck is going on, they had like a card to give them, which said like, this is, you know, like I represent Private So-and-so. And the idea was to just kind of make people think about like all of these, like, you know, sort of phantoms that like for generations, like, you know, were sort of missing from British families and British people's lives and villages, and to just kind of like evoke them. So, I wasn't there. I don't really know how successful this was. I haven't read any of the like, you know, studies that may have been done afterwards to like assess the effects. But that kind of creative project, I think, sits in a really cool space between like, I don't even like, it's history, but like, it's also kind of performance art. It's kind of also like a museum thing, but it's sort of like a play, like whatever that is. I think it's a really, I love that there's that kind of work happening in different spaces these days.
Thank you for sharing that. That's I find that really exciting. I know in Milwaukee there are a lot of murals being painted, and it's really just a wonderful, wonderful thing. I have one more question for you before we end for today. I'm wondering if you can talk about what you hope to do in the future. What are you up to next? What are you hoping for?
Well, I have a lot of different things going on, and it's really it's exciting, like in terms of, you know, my own life journey. What has it meant to do, like, I really sort of thought that being a history professor meant that I could like sit in a room all day and just read books, and it just so not turned out like that. So at Lawrence, we're just at the beginning of a process of looking at the experiences of Black students at Lawrence over, you know, we're talking about over 100 years worth of history, and, you know, trying to really uncover those people and uncover like what the racial climate was like at Lawrence. So not just like, where are the Black students? Can we sort of lift them up? Although that's a really good thing to do, but also, you know, like, you know, is how much was blackface part of like student culture at Lawrence for, you know, in like the 19th century, things like that. So, you know, I have a student research assistant working on that. It's been kind of slowed down by the pandemic, but hopefully we'll be able to kind of gain a little bit more momentum on that this year. So that's happening. We are working on new curricula in the environmental studies program and in the history major. So, you know, I have a lot of stuff that's going on that's not really necessarily like my own research or writing, but that is important and reflects some of these professional commitments that I've been talking about. I'm just finishing an article which looks really closely at like, how do I explain this? So there was this period of about 50 years between the time that George Washington died in 1799 and the time that it became a museum at the end of the 1850s. And what I'm really interested in are the experience of enslaved people who were living at Mount Vernon during those years, and in particular, how they interacted with the many, many, many tourists and visitors and travelers who came to see Mount Vernon even before it was formally designated as a museum. So even while it was still like a private home with like members of the Washington family, like looking out the window and stuff, like people would just like show up and start like wandering around. And the ways in which like they did or didn't register the presence and the lives of Black people is something that I've been trying to figure out. And I've been looking a lot at kind of the what I'm thinking of is the sort of geography of memory. Like, how did people literally interact with the space of Mount Vernon and the landscaping around it? And like see or not see the like landscape of slavery there. So that is an article that I'm just finishing. And, you know, in some ways, like I'm not really, I don't want to, you know, it does really address, a lot of the things that I've been talking about today, but in a sort of oblique, like coming at it from something of a slant, because, you know, I mean, this is the way academic life is. You have these really like big, serious topics like justice and history, and then you sort of have to narrow it down into some like really manageable small thing. So that's what I've got. I've got like this very manageable small thing. It's like Mount Vernon, it's very contained, like period of years. You know, I'm not trying to write about everything, I'm just sort of boiling it down to this, but hopefully that'll come out sometime in the next year or so.
That's exciting. I'm really excited to, you know, hear where your work goes. And I feel like we didn't get a chance to cover a lot of, you know, your work. And I also just really want to mention that, because we had a lot more planned today that we didn't get to. So who knows, maybe we'll have another episode down the road, but I thank you so much for spending time with us today. And I'm really excited to, you know, follow up with you and see where your writing and your work takes you.
Thank you so much. I think if I would say just, like, so much of what I have talked about, I feel like is just, like, I'm not really the expert on it. I'm just kind of the gateway to what I hope a lot of your listeners might get curious to learn more about these alternative histories. To, you know, check out that museum or download a podcast and just, you know, realize that that history is a lot more than what people assume it is, and that like we're all in that story somewhere. So thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much.